This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
You don't just live in your home. You live in your neighborhood as well. So when you're shopping for a home, you want to know as much about the area around it as possible. Luckily, Homes.com has got you covered. Each listing features a comprehensive neighborhood guide from local experts. Everything you'd ever want to know about a neighborhood, including the number of homes for sale, transportation, local amenities, cultural attractions, unique qualities, and even things like median lot size and a noise score. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
True crime fans will love Crime House True Crime Stories, a Crime House original podcast. Every Monday, you'll experience the most notorious true crime cases from that week in history, all linked by a common theme, from serial killers to disappearances to unsolved murders and so much more. Follow and listen to Crime House True Crime Stories, an Odyssey podcast in partnership with Crime House Studios, available now on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
As we all know, a polarized Congress, and within the polarized Congress, we have a divided Republican Party, of which there are some Republicans who know that they have a lot of leverage because of the narrow majorities, are holding out for certain pet projects or certain things they want. So what we have here is pretty significant stakes in terms of, yet again, government potentially shutting down.
And that's what I wanted to ask you about, the continuing resolutions. Is that because of a lack of leadership or primarily gamesmanship, play in the system, both, neither, what?
I think it's both at this point. It's the leadership issues coming, I'm going to say, from the president all the way down. When I say president, it's bipartisan. It was Biden. It was Trump before that, et cetera, et cetera. But it's presidents offering budgets that are generally unrealistic. You know, since this law has been in effect for how to do the budget, goes back to 1976, I think there's only been, I can maybe off on it, one or two presidential budgets that have ever actually been adopted. And so presidents are proposing things that are totally unrealistic given the lay in Congress. And then once you get into Congress, members of Congress know how to game the system. They'll say that, and I'll make up something here, that I'll agree to this budget if I get a new bridge for my district, or I want this, et cetera, et cetera. And when we have the margins, especially in the House, they are so tight. You know, one or two defections, I think it's what, two defections by Republicans at this point, and they don't have enough votes to do anything. So some people can really hold out. So it's gamesmanship. It's being unrealistic. It's lack of leadership. I would also say, the entire process that we put into place 50 years ago is just fundamentally flawed. And so there's just problem upon problem upon problem in terms of how all this operates.
I know a lot goes on and people sometimes conflate issues, but where does debt ceiling negotiation and raising the debt ceiling enter into this?
Well, on one level, they're technically separate, but on another level, they're very much connected. And the reason why I say that is that because, with the exception of a couple of years in the late 90s, we've been running deficits almost continuously, let's say for the last 50 years, as anybody could figure out, if you keep spending more money than you're taking in, what do? You accumulate debt. And our debt ceiling is going up more and more and more. And again, under So by the fact that we're not doing good budgeting and we're not balancing the budget, it raises the debt. Under this same 1974 law, I correct myself, a 1974 law about how to do the budget, it also requires that Congress have to raise the debt ceiling, which basically means authorization for paying debts that we've already incurred. Not for future debts, but already incurred. And what happens if we don't raise that debt ceiling, the government loses its ability to be able to spend money. And so these are separate, on one level, separate issues, voting for the budget, voting to raise the debt ceiling. but they really are connected to the same problem, which is lack of leadership, polarization, unrealistic budgets where we're spending more than we're taking in. So I know for most listeners out there, they're thinking, well, these are just the same thing. Well, pretty close, but technically separate entities.
So for those, how can I phrase this? It's on both sides, it's just a lot of bull is what it is. There's nobody, everybody talks about, you know, Democrats and Republicans about the debt of the country, this, spending that. The truth is they both spend like crazy. They want to spend on what they want to spend on or not collect with tax cuts on whomever they want to not tax. And as a result, the typical working guy gets caught in the middle. Accurate or not? Working man or working woman?
I think it's absolutely accurate at this point. And I will even say that, quote, mainstream economists for many, many years, I think, have also gone along with this. We're saying that, listen, you know, so long as we can manage our debts. You know, it's like at home. You know, we have to all figure out, like, if we buy a house or we buy a car, you know, how much debt can we, you know, can we incur, you know, before it's too much. Mm-hmm. And economists for years kept saying, not a big problem, not a big problem. And suddenly now you're getting economists saying, my God, we owe, what, over $30 trillion? It's probably even higher now or something like that. $30 trillion in debt. We're paying a lot on interest at this point. Maybe it's a problem. But at the end of the day, It's exactly as you said here, is that in Congress, all the members of Congress want to say, gosh, everybody else is getting pork. What I'm getting for my district is really important stuff that my constituents want. Put it all together, and there's almost no collective action incentive to really bite the bullet and do stuff that we need to do.
All right, let me take a break. We come back. I know you're also a professor of law. 14 states sued Elon Musk and President Trump about Doge, and I see things on Facebook from people just blindly aligning themselves behind Elon Musk and Doge, and others blindly disputing what he's doing, and I'm sure the truth is somewhere in between. To me, an analogy would be when you see, like, the sequester. Remember when we had the sequester and they had across-the-board cuts? That always, to me, just smacked logic in the face, because that makes no sense. What you're saying is you might be cutting things that are really good programs because you don't want to pick winners or losers or what are good programs and what are bad, so you just want to cut everything, while meanwhile you continue to fund something that shouldn't be funded, and that never did make sense to me. More with David Schultz when we come back. 622 Traffic Now, WWL. Hi, 627, Tommy Tucker, WWL, back with our friend David Schultz, professor of political science and law at Hamline University. 14 states filing a lawsuit against Elon Musk's authority at Doge and Donald Trump. I would guess, matter of fact, I would bet my 401k Louisiana is not one of the states in that 14 group of 14 filing suit. Tell me what's going on with Elon Musk. Does he have any can the president grant him any authority he wants? Is the president merely acting on Elon Musk's recommendations, and therefore Elon Musk doesn't have any authority? David?
Okay, I'm going to do it. First off, he doesn't have any official authority because he's not a government official, and Doge is not an official government agency. By the way, one of those states suing is probably mine in Minnesota. But he doesn't have authority to do things. But nonetheless, he's exercising incredible.
Is he just advising the president?
He's supposedly advising the president, but it's looking like, if my accounts in the news are correct, you know, he's making requests, making orders for a variety of things to for government agencies to do. Seems to be behind making recommendations about laying off. But ultimately, I guess the question is going to become, first, is he merely making recommendations to the president who's making those orders? That's going to be, you know, factually, we need to clarify that. It's just not clear at that point. You know, I'm speaking like a law professor. We need to get clear on the facts here. Yeah. And two, even if he is relaying that information to Trump, is Trump acting on it? Is Trump acting legally and doing everything he's doing at this point based upon Musk's recommendations? And so we need to do a lot of fact clearing. And I think that may be one of my statements for this morning, is to say, is that there's a lot of noise out there, whether it's on the social media and in the newspapers and so forth. And, you know, in newspapers, television, et cetera, want to get stories out. But I will just simply say that occasionally, maybe more often than not, they're not getting all the facts out that we need to know. And part of what we kind of hope courts can do is clarify some of this in terms of who's actually doing what to whom and et cetera, like that.
It would seem to me if I'm a government employee and I get a memo from Elon Musk telling me to do something, that's what I should do with it because I don't work for Elon Musk. However, if I get a memo from whomever it is that I work for telling me that per the president, et cetera, so I can see where it's got to be removed. Elon Musk can't tell anybody to do anything. However, I don't know that there's any constitutional provision preventing anybody from getting in any president's ear and making suggestions, is there?
We kind of hope that the public, if I were to write a letter and say, dear president, do X, and the president reads my letter and says, yeah, it's a good idea. Isn't that kind of the idea of representative democracy? I get to petition my government and write to them and say, do X or don't do X?
One would think. Thank you, David. A pleasure as always. David Schultz, professor of political science at Hamline University. 6:30, we'll talk about vaccinations and the Department of Health and more when we come back. Right now, it's time for WWL First News. Dr. Susan Hassig joins us now, our friend, associate professor in the Tulane School of Public Health and Tropical Medicine. Good morning, doctor. How are you?
I'm doing all right. It's a little early, but I'm good.
Early for who?
For me. I know you're up with the birds.
I'm ready for lunch.
I'm not.
Let me tell you something. I was off yesterday. Didn't know what to do with myself. I was texting Jordan, and I thought it was like 1:30 in the afternoon. I looked at the clock. It was 8 o'clock. I didn't realize that. So let's talk about vaccines, because I got my COVID the other day. I got my flu the other day. I think I got tetanus. I think that's told me that she told me, my friend Shanika at CVS told me that's all I needed. And here's my thing. You know, again, I was talking earlier about critically thinking, doing your own thinking. Don't let anybody guide you or lead you or anything else. And I guess you can make a case for that when it comes to public health officials. But I don't know how we got to where we are with vaccinations, especially. Because I would always say, doctor, you know, when you and I talked about vaccines, I would say, well, you know, I'll bet if it was back in the days of polio and people were talking about the polio vaccine, there would be no pushback. And then sure as hell, now we have RFK Jr. as the health secretary that has questioned the polio vaccine. And I don't understand what's going on. Thoughts? Jump in where you feel comfortable.
Well, there has been vaccine pushback since there have been vaccines, because people are always concerned about new developments and everything else. But we have demonstrated proof of how useful vaccines individually and collectively have been for us in the almost 75 years since they first emerged in a big way. They have saved hundreds of thousands, if not millions of lives, and reduced disease burdens in, you know, far more people than that because of their protective effects. And for me, it's one of the most frustrating outcomes of, I guess, the ability for anyone with any kind of opinion to get that out and push it forward through things like social media and 24/7 multi-channel news platforms to anyone who cares to pay attention to it. And they don't appear to have any way to get solid counter information that can clarify the matter for them. And it's been an ongoing battle. It's only gotten worse in the last 20 years.
But when you see somebody like Ralph Abraham, Louisiana Surgeon General, because people are going to say, okay, well, he's a doctor, he knows this, he knows that. But I presume that in your training, You've been to medical school or have been in labs with people that have some kind of wacky beliefs, yes or no?
Oh, yes. I mean, and you have to recognize that a clinician that was trained when Dr. Abrams was trained didn't get a lot of public health incorporated into their training. It was a far different set of criteria for training physicians when he went through that process. And nowadays, new doctors get more preventative information, because we've learned that it's far better to prevent conditions than to try and treat them with very expensive pharmaceuticals and medical intervention processes and strategies. No one would have heart disease or cancer now if they didn't live long enough to have those conditions, because they would have died of infectious diseases that we now prevent by vaccines.
Looking at a story here. Louisiana's top public health physician appears to have misrepresented his credentials, claiming in multiple state communications he's family medicine physician despite not being listed as board certified. So you got to do your research and see who's saying what, who's doing this, who's doing that. I think, Dr. Hasek, this is all a result of COVID, because I think people got angry at COVID. I don't know if it was mismanaged or not. I honestly don't. I do know I remember driving around, seeing everything shut down, thinking this is going to cost a whole lot of money, and somebody's going to have to pay for this one day, and ultimately, I guess we are. Knowing now what we know then, and of course, we didn't know then what we know now, could COVID have been handled better? And do you think a lot – let me take a break here for traffic, and you can answer when we come back. And do you think the pushback – that's happening against vaccines is some kind of misdirected anger over the handling of COVID, or just the fact that COVID existed and the shutdown happened and all of this. 6:51, more when we come back. Traffic now, WWL. 6:57, 3 till 7, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Dr. Susan Hasek about Louisiana Department of Health ending all vaccine events and instructing staff not to encourage immunization. She's the associate professor in the Tulane School of Public Health and Tropical Medicine. Doctor, let me table my questions and get to a text here. We have no problem with vaccines. It's RNA that we are problem with. I don't know that people really know what RNA is, but go ahead. Thoughts on that?
Well, I think that, you know, any new technology in the medical field is something that we should pay attention to and monitor very carefully. We have found no serious consequences of the mRNA vaccines.
7:14 now. We got some rain coming in tonight in advance of another cold front. Could bring freezing temperatures to the North Shore. Maybe close to freezing South Shore, but nothing anybody needs to worry about. And then for the parades, it's going to be chilly on Friday night and cool on Friday, Saturday and Sunday, and maybe a chance for showers. It's iffy. They'll have to watch the timing on that. Dr. Fred Lopez joins us now, professor of medicine in the section of infectious diseases at LSU Health New Orleans. How you doing, Dr. Fred?
Good morning, Tommy.
Let's talk about Pope Francis and what's going on with him, because he's pretty sick, is he not?
You know, I only know what the reports are saying, and it looks like he's now in the hospital. He's been in the hospital for several days, initially admitted with bronchitis, which he's had prior to his hospitalization. And on Monday, a big announcement that he's seems to be suffering from a complicated clinical issue secondary to a polymicrobial lung infection, meaning that he has a couple of organisms that have been identified in his lungs causing his infection. And, you know, now that they know what those organisms are, hopefully they can target the treatment appropriately. Is it a combination of a virus and a bacteria or a couple of bacteria? We don't know. That information hasn't been released. But this does sound a little more complicated than just a simple acute bronchitis. And it sounds like he's going to be hospitalized and put at rest from his activities, at least for the foreseeable future, while they try to treat this complicated infection.
Yeah, I shouldn't have asked you or said, prefaced it by saying he's pretty sick, because you haven't examined him. You don't know. But maybe we can talk about that polymicrobial respiratory tract infection, because I'm confused. Is it bacteria or is it viral? And talk about the treatment of either, or fungi or parasites.
Yeah. You know, all of the above. When you hear polymicrobial, it just means a mixture of organisms. And organisms can be viral, they can be fungal, they can be bacterial, they can be parasitic, all of the types you just mentioned. Bronchitis, which is what apparently he initially had before being hospitalized, is typically caused by viruses. The viruses might even include the flu virus, other types of viruses like parainfluenza virus, cold viruses, respiratory syncytial virus or RSV, which we've been talking about, all of these viruses can cause bronchitis. And typically, if it's a virus that we can't treat, which usually is the flu primarily that we can target our therapy, or COVID-19, for example, where we also have targeted therapy, it's usually supportive care and the infection resolves. But once it leaves the lining of the tubes that lead into the lungs can get complicated infections called pneumonia. And that's, I'm sure, of concern to the everyone who hears about complications of bronchitis is, has there now been a superimposed pneumonia on top of this? In which case, if they've identified the organisms, which again, I suspect might be a virus and a bacteria, hard to know that, but that's oftentimes the case, then they can target the therapy against those bacteria and hopefully he'll begin to resolve this infection. But without exactly knowing what the organisms are, I can only speculate that bronchitis usually caused by a virus, and perhaps now what we're seeing is a complication of a viral infection that maybe has led to a pneumonia.
Let's take a step back, and I know this is kind of complicated stuff, but you can vaccinate against a virus, but you can't treat a virus other than with therapeutics. And when it comes to bacteria, you can't vaccinate against bacteria, but you can treat it with antibiotics. Tell me if I said anything true there or not.
Well, there's truth in part to the statements that you made. We do have vaccinations that you and I talk about frequently against some of the viruses, not all of them, but against some of them. So what are those? We have vaccinations against influenza. We have vaccinations against COVID-19. We have vaccinations against respiratory syncytial virus. So we do have viruses that can prevent and moderate infection due to these viral organisms. And then we do have some vaccinations against bacteria. So the pneumonia shot that we talk about, that is a vaccine against a bacteria called Streptococcus pneumonia or pneumococcus, a common bacterial cause of pneumonia. And that is recommended for people 50 years of age or older to receive that pneumococcal vaccine. So we do have vaccinations against both viral pathogens and bacterial organisms. But sometimes the immune system can't handle the colonization of the airways and the lungs with these viruses and bacteria, and it can lead to infection and complications such as the one perhaps we're hearing is involving the Pope.
So an antibiotic will work against the virus or it will not?
No. Again, the difference being that viruses have therapies that we can use against them. Again, the flu is the virus that we typically talk about because we do have treatments that can target the flu virus, things like Tamiflu, for example. That is a flu therapeutic that is effective against that organism, is not effective against bacterial organisms because that's an antiviral. Antibiotics, on the other hand, are not effective against viruses, but they are effective against bacteria. So when we talk about antibiotics like penicillins, for example, and cephalosporins, these are the types of antibiotics that can treat bacterial pathogens that might cause respiratory tract infections. So if an individual has both a viral and a bacterial infection, and the viral infection is due to the flu, and the bacterial infection is due to a bacteria like pneumococcus, we might be using two different drugs to treat that polymicrobial infection.
Let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back. We're talking about Pope Francis, who is in the hospital, not feeling well, with a polymicrobial, I think I'm pronouncing it right, did I say it right?
Doctor?
Polymicrobial infection. We'll pick it up. We come back. 721 traffic now, WWL. 726, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Back with our friend, Dr. Fred Lopez, professor of medicine in the section of infectious diseases at LSU Health New Orleans. Talking about Pope Francis, he's, from what they say, pretty sick with a polymicrobial respiratory tract infection. Doctor, how common is something like this, or uncommon?
Well, bronchitis, which is what he initially had, again, most commonly caused by viruses, is common. It occurs in many, many people and is usually a self-limited infection, usually, that resolves in a few weeks. Here, though, we have a complication of bronchitis, again, speculating that perhaps it's led from the airways into the lungs, maybe complicated by pneumonia, for example. And that's not as common, but it is seen, and just creates a challenge in terms of recognizing what the pneumonia might be due to. Is it just due to the virus? Is it due to the virus plus a superimposed bacterial infection, which is sometimes the case? That's where the multiple organisms come into play, creating a polymicrobial infection. And we do have testing that can identify viruses and bacteria and fungi and parasites, all of those organisms you mentioned earlier. And if you can identify those organisms, hopefully there's good targeted therapy against those organisms in order to help individuals resolve these complicated polymicrobial infections.
I'm sure he's going to get the best of care. He's 88 years old. I think he's lost part of a lung due to pneumonia before, I'm reading here. And I know I had pneumonia as a kid, and my mom used to always tell me that I had to be careful because once you have it, it's easier to get. Is there any truth to that? And what about Pope Francis and having lost part of a lung and having had pneumonia before? Does it make him more susceptible to anything?
Well, you know, he's more susceptible to complications of bronchitis and pneumonia solely because of his age. We know that people who are older, their immune systems aren't as robust, and they're more likely to experience complications from these infections. This is, by report, again, at least the fourth time he's been hospitalized since he was elected Pope in 2013, and at least one of those hospitalizations was for bronchitis. Here we have again bronchitis causing a hospitalization. And then you're right to mention the fact that he underwent lung surgery, removing a piece of the lung apparently in his youth for a respiratory infection. I don't know any of the details except to say that that is documented in multiple reports. And you can live without a piece of a lung. You can live without a whole half a lung being removed. The issue is if he's had repeated infections, it can leave a damaged lung, and a damaged lung is one that is more susceptible to infection as well. So his age and perhaps repeated infections make him more susceptible to additional infections, and that's what we're seeing here. And again, I have to emphasize that it's the very young and the very old who are most likely to suffer complications from respiratory tract infections.
Thank you, Doctor. I appreciate the insight. I know you haven't seen him or treated him, but just a lot of people are concerned, so we thought we'd speak with you. Fred Lopez, Professor of Medicine, Section of Infectious Diseases at LSU Health New Orleans, Dr. Fred Lopez. We come back, we're going to talk about National Engineers Week. Right now, though, time for WWL First News. .714 now. We got some rain coming in tonight in advance of another cold front. Could bring freezing temperatures to the North Shore. Maybe close to freezing South Shore, but nothing anybody needs to worry about. And then for the parades, it's going to be chilly on Friday night and cool on Friday, Saturday and Sunday, and maybe a chance for showers. It's iffy. They'll have to watch the timing on that. Dr. Fred Lopez joins us now, Professor of Medicine in the Section of Infectious Diseases at LSU Health New Orleans. How you doing, Dr. Fred?
Good morning, Tommy.
Let's talk about Pope Francis and what's going on with him, because he's pretty sick, is he not?
You know, I only know what the reports are saying, and it looks like he's now in the hospital. He's been in the hospital for several days, initially admitted with bronchitis, which he's had prior to his hospitalization. And on Monday, a big announcement that he's seems to be suffering from a complicated clinical issue secondary to a polymicrobial lung infection, meaning that he has a couple of organisms that have been identified in his lungs, causing his infection. And, you know, now that they know what those organisms are, hopefully they can target the treatment appropriately. Is it a combination of a virus and a bacteria or a couple of bacteria? We don't know. That information hasn't been released. But this does sound a little more complicated than just a simple acute bronchitis. And it sounds like he's going to be hospitalized and put at rest from his activities, at least for the foreseeable future, while they try to treat this complicated infection.
Yeah, I shouldn't have asked you, or said, prefaced it by saying he's pretty sick, because you haven't examined him. You don't know. But maybe we can talk about that polymicrobial respiratory tract infection, because I'm confused. Is it bacteria or is it viral? And talk about the treatment of either, or fungi or parasites.
Yeah, you know, all of the above. When you hear polymicrobial, it just means a mixture of organisms. And organisms can be viral, they can be fungal, they can be bacterial, they can be parasitic, all of the types you just mentioned. Bronchitis, which is what apparently he initially had before being hospitalized, is typically caused by viruses. The viruses might even include the flu virus, other types of viruses like parainfluenza virus, cold viruses, respiratory syncytial virus, or RSV, which we've been talking about. All of these viruses can cause bronchitis. And typically, if it's a virus that we can't treat, which usually is the flu primarily that we can target our therapy, or COVID-19, for example, where we also have targeted therapy, it's usually supportive care and the infection resolves. But once it leaves the lining of the tubes that lead into the lungs can get complicated infections called pneumonia. And that's, I'm sure, of concern to the everyone who hears about complications of bronchitis. Is, has there now been a superimposed pneumonia on top of this? In which case, if they've identified the organisms, which again I suspect might be a virus and a bacteria, hard to know that, but that's oftentimes the case, then they can target the therapy against those bacteria, and hopefully he'll begin to resolve this infection. But without exactly knowing what the organisms are, I can only speculate that bronchitis usually caused by a virus, and perhaps now what we're seeing is a complication of a viral infection that maybe has led to a pneumonia.
Let's take a step back, and I know this is kind of complicated stuff, but you can vaccinate against a virus, but you can't treat a virus other than with therapeutics. And when it comes to bacteria, you can't vaccinate against bacteria, but you can treat it with antibiotics. Tell me if I said anything true there or not.
Well, there's truth in part to the statements that you made. We do have vaccinations that you and I talk about frequently against some of the viruses, not all of them, but against some of them. So what are those? We have vaccinations against influenza. We have vaccinations against COVID-19. We have vaccinations against respiratory syncytial virus. So we do have viruses that can prevent and moderate infection due to these viral organisms. And then we do have some vaccinations against bacteria. So the pneumonia shot that we talk about, that is a vaccine against a bacteria called Streptococcus pneumonia, or pneumococcus, a common bacterial cause of pneumonia. And that is recommended for people 50 years of age or older to receive that pneumococcal vaccine. So we do have vaccinations against both viral pathogens and bacterial organisms. But sometimes the immune system can't handle the colonization of the airways and the lungs with these viruses and bacteria, and it can lead to infection and complications such as the one perhaps we're hearing is involving the Pope.
So an antibiotic will work against the virus, or it will not?
No. Again, the difference being that viruses have therapies that we can use against them. Again, the flu is the virus that we typically talk about, because we do have treatments that can target the flu virus, things like Tamiflu, for example. That is a flu therapeutic that is effective against that organism is not effective against bacterial organisms because that's an antiviral. Antibiotics, on the other hand, are not effective against viruses, but they are effective against bacteria. So when we talk about antibiotics like penicillins, for example, and cephalosporins, these are the types of antibiotics that can treat bacterial pathogens that might cause respiratory tract infections. So if an individual has both a viral and a bacterial infection, and the viral infection is due to the flu, and the bacterial infection is due to a bacteria like pneumococcus, we might be using two different drugs to treat that polymicrobial infection.
Let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back. We're talking about Pope Francis, who is in the hospital, not feeling well, with a polymicrobial, I think I'm pronouncing it right, did I say it right? Doctor?
Polymicrobial, yes.
Polymicrobial infection. We'll pick it up. We come back. 721 traffic now, WWL. 726, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Back with our friend, Dr. Fred Lopez, professor of medicine in the section of infectious diseases at LSU Health New Orleans. Talking about Pope Francis, he's, from what they say, pretty sick with a polymicrobial respiratory tract infection. Doctor, how common is something like this or uncommon?
Well, bronchitis, which is what he initially had, again, most commonly caused by viruses, is common. It occurs in many, many people and is usually a self-limited infection, usually, that resolves in a few weeks. Here, though, we have a complication of bronchitis, again, speculating that perhaps it's led from the airways into the lungs, maybe complicated by pneumonia, for example. And that's not as common, but it is seen, and just creates a challenge in terms of recognizing what the pneumonia might be due to. Is it just due to the virus? Is it due to the virus plus a superimposed bacterial infection, which is sometimes the case? That's where the multiple organisms come into play, creating a polymicrobial infection. And we do have testing that can identify viruses and bacteria and fungi and parasites, all of those organisms you mentioned earlier. And if you can identify those organisms, hopefully there's good targeted therapy against those organisms in order to help individuals resolve these complicated polymicrobial infections.
I'm sure he's going to get the best.
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof like Aloe, Allbirds, or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling and for shoppers buying simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet and the not so secret secret with Shop Pay that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going. So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell whenever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout experience as business powerhouses like Aloe, Allbirds, and Skims. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/odysseypodcast, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/odysseypodcast to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/odysseypodcast.
Best of care. He's 88 years old. I think he's lost part of a lung due to pneumonia before, I'm reading here, and I know I had pneumonia as a kid, and my mom used to always tell me that I had to be careful because once you have it, it's easier to get. Is there any truth to that? And what about Pope Francis and having lost part of a lung and having had pneumonia before? Does it make him more susceptible to anything?
Well, you know, he's more susceptible to complications of bronchitis and pneumonia solely because of his age. We know that people who are older, their immune systems aren't as robust, and they're more likely to experience complications from these infections. This is, by report, again, at least the fourth time he's been hospitalized since he was elected Pope in 2013. And at least one of those hospitalizations was for bronchitis. Here we have again bronchitis causing a hospitalization. And then you're right to mention the fact that he underwent lung surgery, removing a piece of the lung apparently in his youth for a respiratory infection. I don't know any of the details except to say that that is documented in multiple reports. And you can live without a piece of a lung. You can live without a whole half a lung being removed. The issue is if he's had repeated infections, it can leave a damaged lung. And a damaged lung is one that is more susceptible to infection as well. So his age and perhaps repeated infections make him more susceptible to additional infections. And that's what we're seeing here. And again, I have to emphasize that it's the very young and the very old who are most likely to suffer complications from respiratory tract infections.
Thank you, Doctor. I appreciate the insight. I know you haven't seen him or treated him, but just a lot of people are concerned, so we thought we'd speak with you. Fred Lopez, Professor of Medicine, Section of Infectious Diseases at LSU Health New Orleans, Dr. Fred Lopez. We come back, we're going to talk about National Engineers Week. Right now, though, time for WWL First News. 7:45, quarter till 8, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Rain tonight, freeze tomorrow and the following night for the North Shore, South Shore. Don't worry about it, although after having taken those little sake things off of the faucets, I'm surprised it's not going to freeze on the South Shore. Looking ahead to the parades, Friday night, it's going to be chilly but dry. And then they're talking about some rain on Friday, Saturday and Sunday. It's going to be about the timing of that, but it is going to be a little chilly. UNO helped me in my life more than I can ever thank them. Clancy Dubose once said, UNO built the middle class of the city, and I think he's right. Newell Normand is a UNO graduate. Diane Newman, a boss lady here, is a UNO graduate. So we all think the world of UNO. And Kim Jovanovich joins us now, professor of practice in electrical and computer engineering at UNO. Talk about National Engineers Week. How you doing, Kim?
I'm doing just fine, Tommy. Thank you for letting me talk for a few moments about engineers and how important we are.
Well, I think we all know that. I always tell people when they're asking about occupation for their kid or a career for their kid, I always say, we know things come and go and change, but those same numbers that they use to build a computer or a bridge, that's going to be the same thing in the future as it was then, because it's physics and it's engineers and it's all that kind of stuff, right? Engineering?
Absolutely. In fact, the reason for celebrating National Engineers Week, that, believe it or not, started in 1951, was to encourage diversity within engineering and actually ensure that there would be enough engineers in the future. So the idea was to get as many young people interested in the career field of STEM. Now, I've always kind of joked a little bit about it, but you know, if it wasn't for the E in STEM, it'd be a little hard to pronounce.
Mm-hmm.
The E kind of holds science, technology, and math together. And I explain it this way. Science gives us the laws by which the universe operates. And they express those laws and rules in a special language, and that's the language of mathematics. The engineer comes along, and the engineer reads that language, understands the science, the physics, the chemistry, whatever aspect of science is needed, and it doesn't end there. The engineer now starts dreaming. And that's a little bit of the difference between scientists and engineers. The word engineer comes from the word ingenious, and it tells us exactly what separates us. It's that creativity. It's imagineering, which is the word Disney uses for his engineers. I think that's an absolutely phenomenal word to explain what engineers do. They use their imagination to take and develop new things that weren't here yesterday. And if you look at how we evolved technically as a society, we didn't have phones in our pockets 25 years ago. Had we had something like that in our pockets, massive computers crunching things, they would have thought it came from the Roswell spacecraft. So engineers have to dream. I wonder if I can make a car to drive itself. I wonder if I could have a watch on my arm that tells me where on the surface of the planet I am. I wonder, if I can launch something, hit an asteroid, take a piece of it, and bring it back home. Those are all dreams. But what makes those dreams happen are the engineers and the scientists and the mathematicians together working to make something that seems unachievable actually happen.
I find it amazing, Kim, amazing that you can pick up the phone right now, and you could do this years ago, but that you can pick up, I can pick up the phone right now and call Paris, France, and talk to them. And I think that's the most amazing thing in the world. I can get on an airplane and I can be in Los Angeles 4 hours from now. I think that's the most amazing thing in the world. I'm still astounded when you go out at night and look at the moon and to think that we sent people there, they walked around, and they came back, and we're going to do it again. And that just amazes me. And I guess the questions I have are, moving forward, as people talk about artificial intelligence and this and that and the other thing, you can never take the human factor out of engineering, can you?
I agree. I think that, remember, AI itself is learning from what the human beings have given to it. And it, think about a student. We educate a student. That student then takes and learns on his own or goes about doing a task or goes about doing a job. But that wouldn't happen if it wasn't for the original education they got. AI, of course, is very smart. It can compute things very quickly. I don't ever think it's actually going to replace the engineer. A lot of our students think that because that way they don't have to turn in homework and they don't have to study as hard. But that's not the way it's going to work, at least not in the near term.
Let me take a break, Kim. I'll pick it up when we come back here talking about what specifically is planned at UNO, okay?
Sure, no problem.
All right, 7:51, we're talking to Kim Jovanovich, our friend, professor of practice in electrical and computer engineering at UNO. I'm an English and logic, philosophy kind of guy. I'm not a science guy, and what engineers do never cease to amaze me. 9 till 8, traffic now, WWL. Hi, 7:56 and a half, Tommy Tucker, WWL, back with Kim Jovanovich, professor of engineering at professor of practice in electrical and computer engineering at UNO. I'm distracted here, Kim, because our friend Meg Ferris texted in. Here's something that's so cool. Charlie Duke is one of the few astronauts who walked on the moon still alive. Told me that the phones we carry now have more memory in them than his entire Apollo rocket ship had. So it is
that's
amazing
true.
What they were able to accomplish then and how much the field has grown since then.
Absolutely. So, like I said, UNO loves to celebrate National Engineers Week. It's always the week of President's Week because George Washington was considered a civil engineer. And so that Wednesday of President's Week, we always celebrate it. This year, from 9 to 12, we have 27 companies. NASA is bringing a couple of inflatable planetariums, and we have Entergy and Boeing and the World War II Museum and the Corps of Engineers and the laser interferometry people and Ingalls and Latrim, and 27 outstanding companies in the area will be there demonstrating and talking to young people. We have 35 schools that have signed up to come and 1,100 students. So we ought to be having an outstanding time showing these young people what it's like to be an engineer. And truthfully, science, it's the package. You know, there's been a lot of publicity lately about what's been happening out at UNO. But the real message here, Tommy, is, look, we haven't changed our product. You know, we still produce excellent students, engineering and other career fields. We do our education well. We do our research well. All we've done is change the way in which we go about providing those services. You know, we've streamlined management a little bit. We've streamlined the administration of those duties a little bit. But we're still what we've always been. I mean, we are definitely not going anywhere. And engineering is very strong. So is many of our other colleges. So, UNO is going to be around for a while, and we're certainly going to be generating great engineers in the community.
You know, when somebody texted in, and this is what I love about engineering, and I think it's a great text to wrap it up on. In this day and age, math, numbers are our friends. They cannot lie. If there is one positive, absolute truth, it is in engineering and STEM. Is it not?
I agree.
Thank
Absolutely.
You.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Kim. How can people find out more about what's going on at UNO?
They can contact coedean.uno. Send an email to that, and we'll be happy to reply, or just check out www.uno.edu. Look up the College of Engineering.
Thank you, and for educating engineers and all that engineers have done to help us. Thank you, sir. Kim Jovanovich, professor of practice in electrical and computer engineering at UNO. Thanks to Meg Farris for listening and texting in. Joe LaPinto is coming up, Jefferson Parish Sheriff. 8:15 now, Brooke Laser, WWL Louisiana meteorologist, saying it's going to be the coldest temperature since SNOWLA, and I wonder if she's spelling that S-N-O-W-L-A or S-N-E-A-U-X-L-A. Joe LaPinto joins us now, Jefferson Parish Sheriff. How you doing, Joe?
I'm doing great, Tommy. Good morning.
You driving carpool or not? Usually you are.
No, I actually just got back to the house. I just finished driving carpool. You got me late today.
All right. Let's talk about, before we get to crime in Jefferson Parish, let's talk about Family Graw, and in light of, I don't know, if does the SEER 1 event extend into Jefferson Parish or not, Joe?
Well, it depends, right? SEER 1 event brings in different federal resources, a lot of which we already have. Mm-hmm. You know, you think about it, the SEER 1 event will bring in air support. Well, in Jefferson Parish, we already have two helicopters, mm-hmm. and we utilize our air support for there. It'll bring in an extra K-9 teams and cybersecurity, which we include because I have people that are already assigned to the task force with the FBI. So it really didn't mean a whole lot. Now, the difference is the one big difference is venue security. And what are you looking to do? And certainly we're increasing the security around Family Graw to make sure that we have different jersey barriers in place to keep vehicles away from the crowded areas of Family Graw, which are certainly going to increase the traffic in that area on this Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. But we'll manage it. I mean, we're going to have extra personnel out there to pull the traffic through the lights at Severn and bring them down to the service road and bring them back up Athania. So we're going to try to manage it as best we can in order to keep that traffic down. But most people understand during the parade times and Family Graw times, if you're not going, stay away from that area anyway.
And for people that don't know, a jersey barrier is not a Alvin Kamara jersey where you don't want to fool with that. It's a water-filled thing, Joe?
Either water-filled or cement. We will have a combination of both, and then we'll utilize our big international vehicles in the roadways itself because we want to be able to rapidly open up those areas to be able to get people home after the events. So, you know, we have a pretty good plan in place. We'll obviously have been working on it for the last month or so, putting the different jersey barriers in the static positions, but then we'll end up moving in on Friday and setting up all the different road closures with our vehicles, from Friday on.
I guess the question maybe I should have asked is, for people that are going to Family Graw that always go, is there anything that's going to be different that they need to be aware of?
I mean, you won't be able to drive down Veterans, but no. I mean, most of the parking certainly wasn't on Veterans itself. You're still going to have to park on either the north or south side and walk in. So the set from there will be similar to what it normally is. Security-wise, we'll have additional people, but we've always had a tactical team. We always have our drones up. We have done that for many, many years. So it wasn't like we had to add a bunch of different things to kind of make a better security plan. We had already done that many years ago.
So Vets is going to be closed between North Causeway and Severn, correct?
That is correct, in both directions.
Yeah. Pardon me, I just want to clear that up. Let me ask you this, Sheriff, if I can, and I don't, you know, I know this, you're not the head of Orleans Parish or anything like that, but I was talking to Ronald Surpass last week or somebody, I forgot who, no, J.P. Morrell, I think it was, about a SEER 1 event in Mardi Gras and how that could be if you look at the way different things are set up. Are they necessarily at opposite ends, or can they be complementary? Because if you think about, like, bomb-sniffing dogs, for example, I know when we were at the Super Bowl Media Row, they don't like you to touch the dogs or get near them, and I'm wondering, with all the people that are out there, then you talk about propane tanks, you talk about ice chests, all this kind of stuff. Talk about that, if you will, please.
Yeah, so SEER 1 event really, as I said earlier, does several different things and opens up different federal resources. But when you think of a typical parade, all of a Super Bowl, even though Super Bowl is a Sierra One event, mm-hmm. New Orleans as a city is not a Sierra One event from the standpoint of walking down Canal Street.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the venue security of the Superdome is certainly tight, but that doesn't necessarily mean walking down Canal Street or walking down Convention Center Boulevard or anything else makes any bit of a difference. Another thing is when you're dealing with what does the Sierra One event and what is the cost that goes along with it. I'm realistic to know that a regular concert, think of, you know, a regular concert is not a Sierra One event necessarily, right? But if you put that into an extravaganza or a Bacchus Bash or any of that, now it's a Sierra One event. Well, it normally would not be one. So you also have to be careful of what are you putting in place that you won't be able to replicate next year or the following year because of financial concerns. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't have the ability to just, you know, add $5 million of security concerns onto the backs of these Mardi Gras crews that are barely making it as it is, mm-hmm. you know, in the first time, right? And so you've got to, you know, understand those things. What can you really control? I can control vehicle traffic within the areas of Family Gras, but I can't shut down both sides of Veterans and make a 100-foot blast zone for the entire five-mile route. That's just not the case. I mean, and so in the world of mitigation risk, right, we're looking to make sure we mitigate the ability of a terrorist to be able to get 100 deaths instead of 10. And I know that's horrible.
You want to have
zero, but there's risk in everything that we do, right?
Well,
anytime you have a crowd of individuals, there's risk. And so you're always managing those risks of, okay, what can we do and what is realistic? I can certainly give you a security plan that will make sure that we'll never have a parade again because we won't be able to afford the parade, right?
And I was going to say, while there are people that are going to the parade and want to be safe there or at Family Gras, there are also people that need to get to work and are trying to avoid it and just go about their daily lives, and you can't ignore them either.
Correct. And what does it take to shut down a route, and what does it take to open up that route to move that amount of people back home after the fact? So, you know, look, it's a lot of things that come into play. Certainly we've had a whole bunch of meetings in order to try to make that happen. But look, I think we have a good plan in place. There's always going to be risk. But I think you can always be rest assured that, you know, in Jefferson Parish, we're always going to be there to be able to respond to whatever threat exists. We're going to make sure we have enough people on the streets. I feel safe, certainly, in Jefferson Parish. My wife, my kids will be out there, and, you know, I hope everybody else comes too.
All right, let me take a break. We'll pick it up when we come back. Talking to Sheriff Joe Labinto, 822 Traffic Now, WWL. 827, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Quickly back to Sheriff Joe Labinto. Sheriff, crime in Jefferson Parish at its lowest since the 70s. I know Jeff Ashen, I've seen this story by Michelle Hunter from NOLA.com, says there's no one reason. And you said in a story you'd like to take credit, but realistically speaking, police are reactionary. Public deserves a whole lot of credit for not committing the crimes. But at some point, they have to be deterred, right?
Well, I think it goes back to your previous call. Also, is engineering. There's a lot of different reasons of why crime is so low. We have been tracking these same categories of crime since 74, but certainly this has been a lowest crime rate since well before 74. We look at, you know, different things. If you go back to the 1990s, we would average over 3,500 auto thefts a year. But you think about it. Engineers did a better job of designing their cars to make sure keys are different. The fobs have different things. You can't get into them as easily. And so now we're in 500 auto thefts a year. Certainly had a spike a year or two ago when those Hyundais and Kias were getting stolen because they had the glitch that you could, you know, break into them. But, of course, they fixed that. That the engineers got in and fixed that, and they went back down to normal, right? And so the technology today is always reactionary from the police, but the reaction that you get from the police gives us a lot better opportunity to solve crime. And I always say we solve crime quickly to prevent the next crime from happening. Very seldom are you going to be able to be in the right place at the right time when an auto theft or a burglary is occurring.
You know, I wanted to ask you. Go ahead, finish.
Yeah.
No, finish, please.
But if you go out there and you actually catch the person that did that auto theft from last night, the chance of him doing another auto theft the next day is slim to none because he's still in jail.
First,
and that's the difference.
First of all, I appreciate you listening to the interview with Kim Jovanovich. Secondly, you know, I watch shows all the time, Joe, where I'm watching an old movie and I'm thinking, well, that wouldn't happen today with the cameras that are everywhere. That couldn't happen. I watched a story of some hitman the other day, the Iceman, whatever it is. That couldn't happen because they find him here. Technology really does have a lot to do with, I guess, helping y'all solve crimes. Is that it? And what is the future on this? It seems like we're only touching the surface. Thoughts on that?
You know, cameras are phenomenal. Look, even if it's not a Parrish-owned camera, one of our automatic license plate recognition cameras, just the Ring cameras on everybody's door. You know, it used to be somebody would come and pull on door handles, and you wouldn't know about it until 6 o'clock in the morning when you woke up and went outside and realized your car had got broken into. Now we're going to be able to walk down the street and we're going to literally get a description of the vehicle and the individuals that were pulling on door handles that night. And we're going to go out and look for those individuals, and hopefully we're going to be able to catch them the next day. And so the ability for us to utilize the cameras give us something to go on, right? You know, before we would have nothing to go on other than you woke up, you came outside, and stuff was taken out of your car.
Do you have a hard time?
Well, they don't have a fingerprint.
Do you have a hard time watching movies saying, well, that could never happen?
I just don't watch movies.
There you go. Good for you, Joe. Good for you. All right, thank you, sir. Have a nice Mardi Gras. Sheriff Joe LaPinto, a pleasure as always. We'll talk to State Fire Marshal Brian Adams when we come back. 8:31, minute late. Sorry, guys. Time for WWL First News. All right, 8:56, 4 till 9, joined by Brian Adams, Louisiana State Fire Marshal. Brian and I know each other. Oh, I don't know, Brian. What, decades now? I guess, right?
Yeah, man. Let's don't tell the truth because you know what's going to happen. They're going to know we old.
Well, we don't want that to happen. I just met Brian the other day, as a matter of fact. Tell me, as fire marshal, really, with the cold weather coming in, what people need to know.
Yeah, man. So you know, so the fatality count we've talked about in the past. So as of today, we've had 20 fatalities, 17 fires, 17 incidents across the state. Last year we were at 12, so it's still way up there. One's way too many. So, you know, we have an Operation Save a Life program with smoke alarms. We want to make sure that if you need a smoke alarm in your home, you call your local fire department. They'll be happy to come out and install one. I think we still have about 28,000 of those smoke alarms in our inventory, so we have plenty to give away. So if you need one, get one, because it's the first line of defense to get your family out.
Yeah, he said somebody texted in and said they texted in 3 months ago or something, or asked for one 3 months ago. Apparently, in that case, something gets lost in the shuffle somewhere, and they need to do it again, right?
Yeah, call again. Call again. Call our office. Go to our website, lasfm.org. You can request it on our website. Look, just give us a call. We'll make sure we get it out there. So don't stop trying.
Tell me about space heaters.
Yeah, man. So space heaters, you want to make sure you keep those things 3 to 5 feet away from blankets, curtains, furniture, you know, your sofa and those kind of things. You want to make sure that if you can, try to turn it off at night. You don't want to leave it unattended. I know it gets cold. Cover up with a couple extra blankets if you can. Always plug those space heaters in directly to the wall socket. Do not use extension cords. Extension cords are not made to carry those loads. Never use your stove or your oven to heat your home. It's not made for that. If you got a gas stove, you create some carbon monoxide issues. You don't want to have those. Fireplaces, candles, just make sure you don't leave those things unattended. Make sure they're out before you go to bed at night. And again, always make sure that you check your smoke alarm. Look, I test mine once a month to make sure it still works. So just be real cautious. I know we got another batch of cold weather coming through, it looks like, tonight for the next few days. And then I think it warms up again, but that's the time of year that we see these fatalities rise, you know, with the improper use of all of these heating devices. So,
I would think, Brian, it might be worse when it goes on the roller coaster, because maybe people get out of a routine, and then before you know it, they're doing something they shouldn't be doing.
Yeah, absolutely. But you have to be cautious. You got to check those space heaters. You know, make sure you don't overfill those fireplaces with logs. You know, if you just got a couple in, it's going to do the same as it will if you put four or five in. Candles, those kind of things. Just make sure you don't leave those things unattended.
All right, tell me again the number or the website to get the free smoke detectors.
LASFM.org.
Thank you, Brian. Appreciate your time. Brian All Adams, right. Louisiana Thanks. State Fire Marshal. You bet. When we come back, we're going to spend an hour talking about the school voucher program. Louisiana spent about $500 million on it since 2012, but students who receive them often do worse on state tests than public school students. We're going to take a deep dive on the issue. We'll talk to Douglas Harris, a professor and chair of Tulane's Department of Economics and director of the Education Research Alliance for New Orleans. Then we'll talk to Aaron Bendeley, vice president for policy and strategy at the Pelican Institute. So I will ask you on the Oquinar Jeweler Talk and Text line at 504-260-1870, do you think that vouchers work? Do you think it helps everybody, or does it just help a select few, or is it, as some say, just a help for people already paying private tuition? All right, 9:09 into the 10 o'clock hour we go, and we're going to talk about vouchers and the Gator program, and I'll start with my piece first while we get our guest, hopefully. And I don't know. Here's my issue, and look, I had a kid that went through private school and paid tuition all the way through Ursuline and then Mount Carmel, and it wasn't cheap, but we sacrificed and did what we had to do. My issue with vouchers is it seems as though by supply and demand, the only thing that it does is props up failing private schools. Now, the governor introduced his Gator program at Rummel. I don't know if Rummel accepts voucher students or not, and I don't know exactly how the Gator program is going to work, but if you're subsidizing parents that are already paying private tuition, then I don't know that that's going to do anything to really help the public education system in the state other than take dollars from that. I think that the way it plays out, the schools that accept voucher students, for the most part, the private schools, are not those that are doing very well. And while it gives a parent a chance to take a child out of public school and put them in a private school, it props up the private school that by market demand in the marketplace would not have been there anyway, but for the voucher dollars, if you understand what I'm saying. So the schools that are doing well are packed with students. They don't take voucher students. The schools, the private schools that are not doing well, take voucher students, but then what happens from that point? Does the quality of education for the child go up any? We're going to spend an hour talking about it. Douglas Harris joins us, professor and chair of Tulane's Department of Economics and director of the Education Research Alliance for New Orleans. Good morning, Douglas. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for taking the time. I don't know if you could hear any of this or not, but what I was saying is it just seems from a supply and demand marketplace standpoint, the private schools that are doing well in educating the students, they don't need voucher students because they turn people away every year. Conversely, I think vouchers serve in some ways to prop up failing private schools while not increasing the quality of education any and punishing the public school system overall. Am I anywhere close to right on any of that?
Yeah, no, I think the first part is definitely right on, that the vouchers are not going to have much effect, at least on the number of students in the higher performing schools, those that are in high demand. Although it is, especially with the new program, it is going to start sending money to those families. So if the families that are already in private schools or would have attended private schools anyway will end up getting the voucher under the new program that's being put in place.
That's the Gator program. So let's talk about that. Then we're going to work all over the place here, Douglas, if you can bear with me. So the Gator program is going to people that have kids in Jesuit and Sacred Heart, I'm just going to pick two schools at random, they will be eligible to get subsidies for their tuition?
That's what it looks like it will eventually be. So it's a little bit murky because the program is supposed to be phased in three different tiers, and that depends on what the legislature does. It depends on what the state board does. But you know, the goal of the program from the standpoint of the advocates is to make it universally acceptable and accessible to all families, regardless of income, regardless of any other characteristic, age of the students or anything like that, and to be usable at any religious schools or any other kinds of private schools.
So I'm not picking on Sacred Heart or Jesuit. I just mentioned those because I think those are two of the more popular private schools for boys and girls in the city. But, and again, you said murky, so I don't want to get too lost in the details of the Gator program. But tell me about who accepts voucher students now and who doesn't, or who gets any type. Well, let me check that. Let me go back and go to the inception of this. In Louisiana, the history of vouchers started for parents who didn't want to send their kids to integrated public schools. Is that the truth or not?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, that was true throughout the South. That it was an idea that became popular briefly right after Brown v. Board of Education and the desegregation movement. It was initially a way of sidestepping desegregation.
So then take me through the history of vouchers after that.
Well, not much happened because it was so transparently obvious what they were doing, and it was not legal to try to sidestep what the court was saying at that point, that the idea pretty much died for decades until really the early 2000s, when you started to see another Supreme Court decision that opened the door for vouchers. There's always been a separation of church and state element to this debate because of sending government funds to private schools and religious schools. And so the Supreme Court changed its mind basically in a Cleveland voucher case in the early 2000s, and that opened the door legally speaking. And then you started to see some states, especially Florida, institute some small-scale statewide voucher programs, and there's some small city-based programs as well. And then, but those were small. They were targeted usually to students with disabilities or just students in low-performing schools. You know, Louisiana also came into this in the 2010s with the Louisiana Scholarship Program, and but it's really only very recently, just in the last 4 years or so, that we've had these universal voucher programs where, the intent is that everybody will be eligible for them and that all schools will be eligible to receive them.
Let me quote from Patrick Wall's story here from The Advocate, if I may. Parents and kids should not be trapped in a failing school, then Governor Bobby Jindal said, adding that all children deserve an excellent education. One of several Republican-led states to adopt vouchers, Louisiana targeted its program to families with incomes at or below 250% of the poverty line, with children in public schools rated C or lower. Then they had to administer anyway, tell me, I don't want to read the whole story here because I want you to talk, but tell me what happened after Governor Jindal.
Well, that was when the Louisiana Scholarship Program started. That's one that you're describing. And then that was an interesting one in a couple different dimensions. One is that they required that the students would take the same test as in the public schools, the LEAP test. And the other is that a lot of the students ended up being essentially going in through a lottery. So they were randomly assigned to receive the voucher. And so from an evaluation standpoint, if you want to understand how a program works, it's a great situation where you have an outcome. You can compare the students in private schools to the students in public schools, and you know that they're randomly assigned so that there's no difference between them other than what shows up in their outcomes and the fact that they attended different schools. And what we learned was that the results were really poor, that students did actually a lot worse. The ones that were randomly assigned to receive the voucher and go to a private school did a lot worse academically than the students who remained behind in public schools.
And would that indicate what we started with, that they were using the vouchers to go to an already failing school, but it was a private school, not a public school?
Exactly, that's right. So I think, as you said a few minutes ago, that the schools that you might have wanted or hoped that students would go to the higher performing private schools, at least what we think of. We can't really measure the performance of private schools, so that's important here. But the ones that people would typically think of, you know, ones you mentioned, Jesuit and Sacred Heart and so on, those were not the schools that these students were going to. And you know, there are high-performing public schools, low-performing public schools. There are also high-performing private schools and low-performing private schools. And the system is designed to really send the students receiving vouchers to lower-performing schools.
Let's talk about who accepts vouchers, or once a school, a private school, accepts. Can they accept one voucher student, two voucher students? Do they have to accept a percentage? How does that work, Doug?
I don't think there was a limit. I think the schools could set their own limits in terms of, you know, they might only have a certain amount of capacity, so they could say, well, accept this number of students. And then if more students apply, that's when the lottery would kick in and they would have to randomly assign students to the different schools. So it really wasn't a limit from an individual school standpoint in terms of who participated.
So if I have St. Tommy's School for Kids, okay, and I decide to accept voucher students, I can choose how many I want to accept, and am I getting the full $10,000 a year tuition, and the parent gets a portion of that, and then they have to make up the difference? How does that work?
Well, the current program, the Louisiana Scholarship, is a fixed amount that the state sends to the school, and then that has to cover full tuition, so the school has to accept that as full payment. The Gators program is going to work differently in that that they're going to give the schools a fixed amount, but the schools will be able to top that off with additional tuition. So that'll affect then who can really effectively use the money. So if you're a low-income family, even if you only need to find $1,000 and the scholarship's going to pick up the rest, you still might not be able to find $1,000 to pay the extra tuition to make that work. So
as it stands now, if I'm running St. Tommy's School, that is a business, right? And I do have debt service, and I got to keep the doors open. If I accept a voucher student, I'm not going to get the full tuition that I would get if I have a waiting list of students that want to pay full tuition. Accurate?
Well, it depends on what the tuition level is. Actually, a lot of schools have tuition that's lower than the voucher amount, or close enough that they might not really be sacrificing anything in that respect. So it depends on the tuition level. So again, you think about the Jesuits and Sacred Hearts of the world, it's not going to cover full tuition there. And so they would either the schools would have to change their policies to accommodate this, or again, you might end up with some families who want to go there and can use the voucher but still can't afford the rest of the tuition.
So what is your research on school vouchers found, and are they working in Louisiana?
No, they're not working by the usual academic measures. So again, the test scores I described earlier, things got worse. Yeah, students did worse than if they had stayed behind in public schools. And there was no improvement in, say, college going. So the things that we typically look at that we can measure, things got worse. And it was also true in other states that tried this: Ohio, Indiana, Florida is a little bit of an exception. That's the only state where they've seen any positive effects on college going, but no state has shown any positive effects on test scores. In fact, they all show either no effect on test scores or reductions in achievement.
When you say test scores, the metrics that are used, are they the same for public and private schools, or are they different?
In Louisiana, it's the same. In I think there was one other state where it was the same. In Florida, it's a different test. And actually, with the Gator program that's coming up, it will be a different test. And so, you know, in that respect, we may never know actually how the Gator program is working, because we won't have any way to compare the students who are in that program with those who are in public schools.
So it would be murkier almost?
Oh, for sure. Yeah, I mean, really, we may never know whether the program works or not in that respect.
What is the metric now? They both private and public schools, is it the LEAP test? What do they take?
Correct. That's right.
But when the Gator program kicks in, the private schools will not be taking the LEAP test? Or take me through that.
Correct. Well, it's only the students using the vouchers anyway. So So right now it's not all students in private schools taking the leap. It's only those who are receiving the voucher. And then with the Gator scholarship, the students will, again, have to take some sort of a test, but the schools and students will be able to pick the test. So that means it's not going to be comparable in any way to the public schools.
Let me take a break. We'll digest what we've heard so far, pick it up when we come back. We're going to talk to Erin Bendeley in the second half of the hour. She's Vice President for Policy and Strategy at the Pelican Institute. She is strongly pro-voucher, and we'll see what she has to say when we come back after the bottom of the hour. But we have more with Douglas Harris when we return, professor and chair at Tulane's Department of Economics and director of the Education Research Alliance for New Orleans. It seems like we're just laundering money to subsidize parents that want to send their kids to private school. And look, I did it. I made the sacrifice. I didn't drive a brand new car, but the kid got the education that I wanted the kid to have. And I don't know how this is going to change anything, but hurt public schools. We'll see when we come back. Tommy Tucker, WWL. All right, 9:30. We're going to talk to Erin Bendeley in a couple of minutes, give her as much time as we can to talk about the voucher program and the Gator program. Douglas Harris, our guest, professor, chair at Tulane's Department of Economics and director of the Education Research Alliance for New Orleans. Students achieving mastery on state tests, 32% of all public school students, 24% of low-income public school students, 14% of voucher students in private schools. So Governor Landry tweeting that with President Trump, we'll continue working towards education freedom for all. President Trump wants subsidies, private school subsidies, all families, regardless of financial need. When it comes to the new Gator program, when it comes to students receiving vouchers, is there any way, in your opinion, Douglas, that you can see this working, or is it a fatally flawed program?
Well, if the goal is to raise achievement and to increase the usual measures that we look at, then I don't really see a way that this is going to work. I mean, the evidence is pretty clear, and it's clear across states. You know, there are other ways to look at this. You know, the charter schools have been effective in New Orleans, and having some sort of accountability for the program. They're actually reducing the accountability. I mentioned earlier that students aren't going to be taking the same test, so it won't be possible to compare to public schools or really to release any meaningful information to parents to help them make decisions. You know, there's one other element that I know it's going to come up later in your show with the next speaker, which is, you know, the idea that the program, it may say, is overregulated, but the existing one where the results are really poor, that's why the program didn't work. That's the allegation. But there's also no evidence for that either. You know, the problem, it goes back to what you said at the beginning of the show, which is that the schools that you might want the students to move into are very unlikely to accept more students. And that's why schools are not participating. It's not because the program was overregulated. And the way in which it is overregulated, and one thing that schools I think are concerned about, private schools, is that the program doesn't let them pick their own students, right? So private schools have selective admissions, and especially, you know, the more elite, more expensive schools are not letting in all students. Like they're selecting, just as, like, colleges will select the students that they prefer. And so you know, that's the regulation that they're talking about. That's what they don't want. They want to be able to pick their students. And I think when you think about the public aims,
go back again on that. Because let me tell you this: when my kid went to school, they had took a test, they had an interview process, then they decided whether or not to let the kid into school. Right. So is that what they call? Tell me how that relates to regulation.
Well, what the advocates for the voucher program are saying is that the private schools should be able to continue to do that. That's a standard practice in most private schools, is to be able to select students in the way you just described. And with this new program, they're still going to be able to do that. So you might have a voucher, and you might even be able to pay the full amount, even if they charge tuition at a given school, but the school might not let you in. They're not required to let students in.
So then common sense would tell you that the student is going to, and the parents are going to take the voucher money or the Gator money and go to, as we began this interview, with the failing private school already, right? The school is already failing.
Right. Right. And then that's the sense in which, you know, the regulation is not the problem. It's just the design of the program is what's going to make, you know, that problem happen. And even if you know, even setting aside that, the idea that the program is overregulated or highly regulated is misleading, because it really only two rules that matter here. One is the idea that the schools can still, or in the old program couldn't select. So in the old program, even where and the results were really bad there too, they also couldn't select their program. Under the Gator program, they will be able to select. So that's one of the things that's changing that I think people don't really realize, is that that restriction is there, and not everybody's going to get the school that they want. And the other regulation is even having to take the public school test at all. Like, that's considered to be onerous, but it's really seems pretty pretty basic for an organization receiving public funds.
I have to go here because I want to give Aaron as much time as I can. Real quick, Douglas, is there a scenario under which you see a voucher program working successfully?
Not okay. If the goal is to improve achievement, no, I don't see a way that there are other goals that you might have, you know, supporting religion and religious organizations and so on, but it's hard to see from an academic achievement standpoint how this would be helpful.
Thank you, Douglas. Appreciate your time. Professor Chair at Tulane's Department of Economics and Director of the Education Research Alliance for New Orleans. I hope Erin Bendeley was listening, because we're going to talk to her. We come back, Vice President for Policy and Strategy at the Pelican Institute, who are very much in favor of vouchers, and the Gator program, 9:35, 25 till 10. Traffic now, WWL. You feed a lot of hungry people, and they need volunteers to help at the food pantries on either the East or West Bank. If you can help, go to givinghopenola.org. All right, 9:40, 20 till 10. Quickly to Erin Bendeley, Vice President for Policy and Strategy at the Pelican Institute. Morning, Erin. How are you?
Good morning, Tommy. I'm doing great. And you?
I hope you were listening just now, were you? Because you're going to save me a lot of time if you were.
Unfortunately, I was not.
Okay.
You're going to have to bring me up to speed.
Well, we're
so
talking
sorry.
To Douglas Harris, Professor and Chair of Tulane's Department of Economics, Director of the Education Research Alliance for New Orleans. He was talking about the Gator program and vouchers, how they failed miserably. And he thinks that, I'm trying to go to my notes here, that under regulation is not going to be the answer for people that have said that the program is overregulated. And a final question I asked him was, does he see in any way, shape, or form a voucher program working for the betterment? And I'll just give you a little background. I think that what's happened is it's propped up failing schools, or if the Gator program is going to be a subsidy for parents that are already paying private tuitions, well, what's that going to do to the public school system? And the other question I'll have, Erin, I'll throw at you, and then I'll turn the floor over to you, is, look, I paid private tuition, right, for Ursuline and Mount Carmel. So I get it, but I made a lot of sacrifices. At the same time, I was angry that I had to pay for a public school system that I chose not to use. So I get that part of it as well. Tell me why you think vouchers will work or do work or have worked.
Well, that was really helpful. Thank you for that. And I have followed Dr. Harris's work for a number of years and have a lot of respect for him. But I think we have to really start with the new Louisiana Gator program is not a voucher program. That's the first very important fact here. This is a very different kind of program.
Tell
and we
me
can
how.
Certainly go in. The main feature, well, a couple of things. With regard to how you can use your Gator scholarship, let's start there. What others call the old voucher program, scholarship program, really only gave families one single choice, and that is to take that amount of state money and use it for basically all or nothing. You had to enroll your child full time in a private school. The Gator program and what you may call education savings account programs throughout the country allows families to completely customize their child's education to meet their individual needs. Now, that could be enrollment, full-time enrollment in a private school, or it could be a totally customized home-based program where they purchase individual courses, they purchase tutoring, they contract with an educational service provider for career training or for dual enrollment, college prep, educational therapies, whatever that child may need. So this is a completely different program in terms of how families can actually use it to personalize their kids' education. There are also very different aspects of this type of program with regard to participating schools and providers. One of the things that we've learned a lot of lessons about over the years, and what the research shows, is that in an attempt to, unfortunately, do what we have done in the public education system, when we try to control quality through loads of regulation, bureaucracy, and red tape, we inadvertently limit the number of high-quality choices available to students and kids, particularly disadvantaged students, because we know that when we regulate a program to death and we try to turn private schools into public schools, it's no surprise that a lot of those schools and providers say, you know what, we're out. We're not participating. So these ESA programs do a much better job of respecting the independence and autonomy, and frankly, what has made private education attractive to families for generations. It allows them to do that with less government interference, and really, they are accountable to the person who matters most, and the person who knows their kid better than anyone else, and that's the parents.
All right, let me go to my example, right? So my kid went to Ursuline, went to Mount Carmel, and they had a, I believe, a test was given, and there was an interview, and then there was a selection process based on a lot of, kind of like college, I guess, in a way, and then you were either accepted or you weren't. With this Gator program, the schools will still have the same choice in doing that, right?
It's true that schools are not going to be required to change their student handbook, to change their policies and procedures just because they're participating in this program. And I think that's important for a number of ways. Again, I just said it. This is what has made these schools successful, if you will, for generations. It's the reason why families are opting to put their child in these schools instead of public schools or other schools. And I think it's important for families to be aware of the type of school culture that exists if they're going to put this child in that school for most of the day, to know what the expectations are, to know what the culture is, and frankly, to know what their expectations are as parents to support the child's learning and behavior. Some misinformation that's out there that I hear a lot recently is, oh, well, private schools are just going to cream students, or they're only going to take certain students, and a lot of disadvantaged students are not going to be allowed in. I just don't think the evidence is there to support that. I've seen plenty of private schools throughout the years.
Hang on one second. Let me just jump in for a second. As a parent, why would the private school take on any new students or any disadvantaged students when you know they're going to be getting pushback from parents whose children have already been accepted by afraid that, and I'm just going to say it, that the disadvantaged student's going to bring the rest of the class down? And how does this not just turn into the Gator program with parents get the schools, let me try to get this out, schools still accept the students that they would have already taken. The only difference is the parents are getting a help with the tuition from the state, and nothing really changes as far as the disadvantaged students, and they wind up being funneled into the so-called failing private schools already, other than a home education. Take me through that.
Well, I'm certainly not saying that 100% of every application is that all applications are going to be granted. That's not the case today, and that's certainly not a government requirement of this program going forward. But what we do know is that many, I would say most of the private schools across our state have a mission. Many of them are connected to churches or faith-based institutions, or just have a reputation and a long history of accepting a pretty diverse student body, accepting students that have special needs, accepting students that are academically behind, and that is part of their mission and why they exist. And while families and communities have supported them throughout the years to be able to ensure that they serve as many families as possible, there are plenty of private schools across our state that regularly fundraise for the purpose of being able to admit low-income disadvantaged students. I think we have to recognize that fact, and there's pretty overwhelming evidence to support that.
I think sometimes that can be done. I hate to use the word token, but I think it, sometimes that's done to be made to look as though they are looking for diversity. But I do know that when it comes to selling points for a lot of private schools, they like to talk about scholarships that were received. They like to talk about national merit scholars. So they're very selective about who they let in with an eye toward the back end and attracting new students. And you're saying that this is not going to have any effect on any of that at all, that the institution will be more than willing to take in disadvantaged students, even though there may not be as many merit scholars, there may not be as many scholarships handed out, et cetera, because I don't see that happening.
Again, we know the free market works. We know that good, healthy competition, even in the educational system, works.
But wait, hang on. I'm not trying to argue, Aaron, but as far as the free market goes, since you said that, it seems to me the free market is working in that the schools that are performing well, they don't need any vouchers or students, or they don't need any subsidies for the tuition because they're full. The schools that are not doing well, free market-wise, are the private schools that are not doing so well, and it seems as though those are the ones that are being propped up, and the data kind of indicates that, doesn't it?
Well, what we've heard directly from schools is that where they feel like they can continue doing what they have done, again, for generations, that families have found valuable to their children, and where the state does not basically force them to conform to the way that we have set up public education across our state, that's when you see schools participate in programs like this, where they know they're going to be able to continue to teach according to their own academic standards, their own curriculum, have expectations for behavior, et cetera. Again, we have to be very careful in essentially using an innovative program like this to force private schools, you know, independent, autonomous schools that are not run by the government, to essentially try to force them into a public school model, which I think we can all admit has had its own significant struggles throughout the years. But we've seen that.
Right. And along those lines.
By evidence, by families leaving the public school system in droves. And we're trying to address that through a number of issues on the public side. But we have to make sure that, again, this is a program to put families in the driver's seat and to make sure that they're choosing something that will work for their child.
Tell me, how do you determine if this is a success or not years from now?
I think we look to see if there's a good, healthy participation in the program, both by families across the state and by schools and providers. I think we also need to look at parent satisfaction. And unfortunately, that was not something that was covered in the article that ran this past weekend. 94% of families surveyed this past year indicated that they were happy with their choice of a school for their child and that they were satisfied with their child's academic progress. And we know that there's a lot that goes into that, not only test scores, but also do kids feel safe? Do they feel like they have the support that they need at school? Are their individual needs or disabilities being met? What really matters is it working for that child and their family?
Aaron, thank you. You can come back anytime you want because it's not going to go away. We'll continue to talk about it. Aaron Bendeley, Vice President for Policy and Strategy at the Pelican Institute, 952, 8 till 10. We'll find out what Newell's got planned for us when we come back on WWL.